This is Free Speech Radio News for the 23rd of January, 2008. From Beirut, Lebanon, I'm Jackson Aller, sitting in for Aura Bogado. In today's program, we get the Israeli and Palestinian reactions to the current humanitarian situation in the Gaza Strip. Democratic presidential hopefuls are in South Carolina looking to sway voters for Saturday's primary. And a report released today says that the Bush administration issued 935 false statements on the security threats posed by Iraq in the years following 9/11. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with today's headlines. The government of the Democratic Republic of Congo signed a peace deal today with various armed factions operating within the country. The DRC formally emerged from a brutal civil war 5 years ago, but fighting has continued to displace entire communities in the eastern region. Newly compiled data from the International Rescue Committee shows that the conflict and humanitarian crisis in the Democratic Republic of Congo continues to kill up to 45,000 people a month. In the past 10 years, the conflict has killed 5.4 million people, making it the deadliest conflict since World War II. An African Union delegation led by the AU's Peace and Security Commissioner arrived in Mogadishu today for talks with the government and AU peacekeepers. Mohamed Sheikh Noor reports from Mogadishu.
During the one-day visit, the African Union Peace and Security Commissioner Saeed Jinit and his delegation met the new Prime Minister Noor Hassan Hussein to express support and to discuss security matters and the deployment of more African troops. The AU had originally agreed to maintain a force of 8,000 soldiers, but member nations have been hesitant to send their troops to the volatile region. Somalia's presidential palace and the Mogadishu airport came under mortar attack during the meeting between the Prime Minister and the AU diplomat. Mortar attacks near the airport killed one boy and injured two others. Police blame the Al-Shabaab armed group for today's attacks. The Al-Shabaab has been waging a relentless campaign to expel foreign troops and re-establish Islamic rule across Somalia. Reporting for FSRN, this is Mohamed Sheikh Noor in Mogadishu.
A new repatriation agreement between the United States and Vietnam has cleared the way for the U.S. to deport undocumented Vietnamese people who immigrated to the United States after July 12th of 1995, the day the two countries restored diplomatic relations. Tanya Snyder has more on this story.
The Memorandum of Understanding between the United States and Vietnam took a decade to negotiate due to Vietnam's reluctance to accept the returnees. Nguyen Dinh Thuong, executive director of Boat People SOS, says he sees both sides, but urges caution.
On the one hand, the U.S. wants to deport these considered as illegal from the U.S. back to their country of origin. On the other hand, we are obligated to ensure that there's protection against persecution.
8,000 Vietnamese nationals have deportation orders from the U.S. or are currently in deportation hearings, but without a repatriation agreement, there was no way to send them back, until now. Although only those who came after July 1995 are vulnerable for deportation at the moment, some fear that future amendments could cast a wider net. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Tanya Snyder in Washington.
Italy's coalition government is on the brink of collapse due to the exit of one of its key members. Diletta Varlese has more.
Italy's Minister of Justice and leader of the Udeur party, Clemente Mastella, has resigned from the ruling coalition government in the wake of formal corruption charges brought by an Italian magistrate. Mastella's resignation prompted his party to withdraw from the coalition government led by Prime Minister Romano Prodi. Prodi must now face a confidence vote in Parliament in order to see if he has enough support to conclude his term in office. The lower house is expected to support Prodi in its vote today, but his coalition does not have a majority in the Senate. The Senate vote tomorrow will determine if Prodi will continue in office or if Italians will vote in early elections for a new government. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Diletta Varlese in Brescia, Italy.
The European Commission announced a new plan today to cut greenhouse gas emissions by 20%, produce 20% of its energy from renewable sources, and increase energy efficiency by 20%, all by 2020. Cinnamon Nippard has more from Berlin.
While Germany's environment minister called the Climate Action and Renewable Energy Package both ambitious and courageous, environmental groups were less impressed. Friends of the Earth Europe says that the EU has backtracked on Bali commitments and that 20% emissions cuts aren't enough. The latest proposal only requires EU member states to report on their emissions cuts. Friends of the Earth says that reduction targets need to be binding and member states must prove that they're cutting their emissions year by year. Despite opposition from environmental groups and NGOs, the Commission also set a target of 10% use of agrofuels in transport. Environmental groups say these crops undermine food security in the global south and increase CO2 emissions as forests are destroyed to make way for plantations. Member states must first approve the European Commission's proposal before it can come into force. Cinnamon Nippard reporting for Free Speech Radio News in Berlin.
And those are the headlines. I'm Shannon Young.
We're joined on the line with FSR and correspondent in Jerusalem, Iris Makler. Iris, we're trying to get the Israeli reaction to what is going on in Gaza. The U.S. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice said the Bush administration has spoken to Israeli officials about the importance of not allowing a humanitarian crisis to unfold. Could you let us know a little bit more about what people on the ground are saying in Israel about the current situation?
Well, there's two levels, of course. There's ordinary people and there's official Israel. And official Israel has been very quiet. There's been a small leaks of people saying it's up to the Egyptians, we leave it to the Egyptians to resolve this. And other than that, there hasn't been much here, which is actually most uncharacteristic because usually everybody takes every opportunity to comment. And I think what that indicates is that the policy that Israel had adopted of relying on an economic blockade to halt the rocket fire from Gaza to get the people in Gaza to turn on the militants and stop them from firing rockets into Israel, that policy now has to be re-examined because today what we saw ultimately was its failure. You know, the people just walked right out of that wall and the dam burst its banks and now Israel has to reconsider.
Is there any sense of what that policy might be from the Israeli government as to what they might need to do to stop the rocket fire coming from Hamas in Gaza?
Israel, with all its military might, with its sophisticated equipment that allowed it to carry out pinpoint military operations, targeted killings of militants on their way to carry out, to fire rockets, even with all of that, the rocket fire didn't abate. In fact, in the past 2 weeks, it increased, and they were firing rockets, you know, by the hour into southern Israel. Those rockets don't, you know, they don't hit much, but they'd certainly sow terror in the general population here. So it's a sign of desperation, and it's also a sign, I think, that Israel isn't prepared to launch a full-scale military operation, and therefore it has to either tackle talking to the Islamic group Hamas, or it has to find some third solution, which it hasn't yet found.
Is talking to Hamas actually a possibility?
You know, I have heard some people suggest that it should be done, and when I say some people, I mean ex-military men, a former commander of the of Israel's forces in Gaza, the Southern Command. He says that when Hamas offers a 10-year hudna, you know, a 10-year ceasefire, Israel should grab it. But they are lone voices. The more common political voice is that until Hamas agrees to recognize the state of Israel, then there's no point negotiating with someone who seeks your destruction.
And how about the intended goal of President Bush is to try to complete a peace accord by the end of the year? On the ground, does that seem like it's a possibility? What do people on the ground in Israel think?
The underlying problem with President Bush's deal, if you like, that he envisages within a year, is that it's not going to be a two-state solution. It's actually going to be a three-state solution. Israel, Palestine, that is the West Bank, negotiated with Abbas, and Gaza. So, and that's the best case scenario. And not many Palestinians want to see that, and I don't know if Israelis do either.
Thank you. FSR and correspondent Iris Makler reporting live from Jerusalem on the Israeli reaction to the current situation in Gaza.
Thank you.
Tens of thousands of Palestinians in Gaza made their way into nearby Egypt on Wednesday to bring in essential supplies like food and fuel after explosions tore a hole in the wall on the Gaza-Egypt border line. FSRN's Rami Al-Maghari has more.
The Gaza Strip is on the brink of a humanitarian crisis following the Israeli government's decision last Friday to completely seal off all of Gaza's crossings and prevent the delivery of many essential supplies, including fuel, to the coastal region. Yesterday, as the United Nations Security Council convened to discuss condemning Israel's actions, Israel declared a one-day ease off on its restrictions. However, the crisis that broke out early this week with severe electricity and fuel supplies shortages persists. John Ging, director of the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestine Refugees, or UNRWA, explains.
It is not enough to just send a trickle of food and medicine into the Gaza Strip, as has been happening over the last 7 months. The supplies to Gaza have been reduced by 70% on what they were last June. This has also had the inevitably predicted result. Everything is in short supply. Medicines. We have no paper to print textbooks. We have no paper to print examination papers for the children's exam. There are no light bulbs available in the shops. There is no cement to prepare the graves for those that are dying.
Gaza's population has recently suffered a blackout ranging from 8 to 10 hours a day, as automobile traffic has been reduced by nearly 50% due to the cut in fuel supplies. The decrease in the amount of fuel shipped to the coastal region began on October of last year when the Israeli government declared it was attempting to stop homemade rocket fire from Gaza into nearby Israeli towns. According to the Palestinian Petroleum Authority in Gaza, the Strip used to receive 600,000 to 700,000 liters of fuel from Israel per day. However, this amount has been cut by more than 50% since October 2007. Mahmoud Al-Khazandar is deputy chief of Gaza's fuel stations.
I think the Israeli people is not telling the truth, because the area is living in very harm situation of severe shortage of electrical supply, of severe shortage of fuel supply, of severe shortage of all of aspects of life. So I think these figures is not enough for any of the essential life of Palestinian people, because the amount of diesel is going to UNRWA. It's not going for cars, for schools, for vehicles, for transport, for all of aspects of life.
Over the past 6 decades, the UNRWA has been providing social, education, health and sanitation services to the Gaza's population. The agency's operations director early this week warned of a severe shortage of essential items that they provide Palestinian refugees. Another major contributing factor during the months of crippling economic conditions throughout Gaza has been strict travel and commercial border restrictions imposed by Israel since last June. Among these crossings are the Eretz in northern Gaza, the eastern Karni, and the southern Kusafim commercial crossings, as well as the Rafah terminal crossing in southern Gaza, considered to be the sole outlet to the outside world for Gaza's residents. In August 2007, Israel allowed the return of 6,000 Palestinians to Gaza after having been stranded in Egypt for a couple of months, when Israel ordered the closure of the Rafah terminal in June 2007. Since then, the number of those stranded has been steadily increasing, as the Palestinian Human Rights Center in Gaza suggests that there are more than 1,500 others who have been waiting to return to Gaza from Egypt for the past 5 months. On Wednesday, the United Nations launched from Jerusalem its largest emergency appeal for the occupied Palestinian territories, and it is considered to be the third of its type after Congo and Sudan. According to the UN, 57% of the Palestinian families in Gaza and the West Bank are living in poverty, and 79% live in the Gaza Strip alone. To alleviate such poverty, the UN's appeal calls $462 million for the year 2008. According to the Palestinian Economy Ministry, unemployment rate in Gaza has been increased since June 2007, with 90% of Gaza's local industries closed, leaving 70,000 local laborers jobless. In Al-Shata refugee camp in western Gaza, Afasar Ann visited one of the poor families who depend on the UNRWA's assistance. 42-year-old Mahmoud Abu Marasa is an unemployed father.
أنا ورش عندي خمس أطفال. طبعاً بعتمد على المساعدة اللي بأخذها من.
I have five children. I'm dependent on the UNRWA's food assistance, so once this assistance is cut, my family and I will definitely be destroyed. I might commit a crime at any time in order to ensure bread for my children. Today I depend 100% on the UNRWA's and social pensions assistance.
In September
2007, Israel declared Gaza a hostile entity and began in October a series of apparently punitive measures on the 1.5 million strong population, including a reduction of the amount of fuel shipped from Israel. Israel says its actions on Gaza are meant to stop homemade rocket fire into nearby Israeli towns. Since the beginning of this week, Palestinian resistance groups, including the ruling Hamas, claimed responsibility for firing scores of mortar shells and homemade rockets into southern Israel. Israel imposed a strict closure on the Gaza Strip last June when the Islamist Hamas movement took over the coastal strip amidst a power struggle with Fatah Party for President Mahmoud Abbas, who embraces a peace strategy. For Free Speech Radio News, I am Rami Al-Mighari in Gaza.
We podcast at www.fsrn.org. That's fsrn.org. You can email us your feedback, questions, and story ideas to comments@fsrn.org. Democrats are gearing up for their next primary in South Carolina, which will take place Saturday. The state is considered the gateway to the South, and the three top Democratic candidates are looking for an edge. Barack Obama is doing well there, but must overcome numerous challenges. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports.
Barack Obama has his loyal supporters. 49-year-old Linda White has never voted before.
This is the first time I've felt this positive about a candidate.
But this assembly line worker not only plans to vote Saturday, but has been volunteering for the Obama campaign.
You know, for me, he's the perfect president for the country stands right now. It's so divided and it's so, it's a total mess. You know what I'm saying? They counted this morning. They said they found 946 lies George Bush told to the lead up to a war. And I'm like, we don't need that anymore.
At Winthrop University in Rock Hill, South Carolina, a small town near the North Carolina border, Barack Obama tried to convince those who aren't so sure. To do that, he has changed his campaign style slightly. He's now attempting to distinguish himself from his opponent, Hillary Clinton.
You, the voters, have to know what these disagreements are, because you can't always tell what Senator Clinton's position on trade has been. She said that NAFTA had led to all kinds of economic improvement. She said this up until last year. Before she ran for president, she supported making it easier to trade for China. But now it's a different story. Now that we're in a campaign and it's not all that popular to tell working people, especially in South Carolina, that you were for trade agreements that sent jobs overseas.
That tactic, especially on trade, to a state that has seen a lot of jobs head overseas, just might have won over assembly line worker Alfred Upchurch, who walked into the Obama event a Clinton supporter.
That's something that kind of sort of took me from Hillary Clinton because of the fact that her husband was the one that enacted NAFTA. And I believe that President Obama would hopefully be on the side of the working man.
But proving himself over Clinton isn't Obama's only challenge in South Carolina. He's gaining increasing support among the black community, but he must also maintain and continue to grow his support among white voters in this southern state where racial prejudices exist. He must also overcome slanderous emails and websites depicting Obama as a Muslim and unpatriotic. They've been surfacing since he announced his candidacy, but they have become more intense in recent days, and they are well known here in the Palmetto State. 25-year-old stay-at-home mom Barwin Kratz says she's received numerous bulletins on her MySpace page and emails about this.
They were saying that his background was Muslim and his middle name was like Hussein or something like that. And so that kind of made me take back even considering Obama.
It did.
Yeah, it did. It did. Because I was like, I don't want somebody that, you know, I believe that he is a patriot of the United States. However, him being Muslim and having a middle name like Hussein and, you know, things like that kind of scared me off a little bit, to be honest.
Robert Gibbs, Obama's communications director, says the intensity of the emails are becoming, quote, very problematic. To combat these falsities, the campaign launched a truth squad, volunteers to go out and address the issues. The campaign also created a page on his website countering the attacks, saying that Obama is an active Christian and a member of the United Church of Christ. They've also recruited help in dispelling rumors. 2004 presidential nominee John Kerry used his massive database to send correct information about Obama's background. All these are unique challenges Obama must face as his viability for the nomination continues. For Free Speech Radio News in South Carolina, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
Today, the Center for Public Integrity released a report saying that President Bush and other top White House officials issued 935 false statements on the security threat posed by Iraq in the years following 9/11. According to the report, the administration took part in, quote, an orchestrated campaign to capture public opinion and lead the country into war. But as FSRN's Karen Miller reports, some say these same messages are continuing to be used to manipulate the public even today.
According to the report, the list of those who participated in the deception of the threat posed from Iraq reads like a list of who's who in the White House. It includes the President, Vice President Cheney, former Secretary of State Colin Powell, then National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice, former Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld, former Deputy Defense Secretary Paul Wolfowitz, and former White House Press Secretaries Ari Fleischer and Scott McKellen. Of that group, President Bush was a top offender, making 260 false statements. Here he is back in October of 2002, conjuring up negative images of Iraq while not saying that the U.S. was a past ally of the country.
We know the treacherous history of the regime. It has waged a war against its neighbors. It has sponsored and sheltered terrorists. It has developed weapons of mass death. It has used them against innocent men, women, and children. We know the designs of the Iraqi regime. In defiance of pledges to the UN, it has stockpiled biological and chemical weapons. It is rebuilding the facilities used to make those weapons.
Then Secretary of State Colin Powell comes in second place with 244 false statements, while Donald Rumsfeld and Ari Fleischer each made 109 false statements, followed by Wolfowitz with 85, Rice with 56, Cheney with 48, and Scott McKellen with 14 false statements. Of the statements, all refer to weapons of mass destruction and links to Al-Qaeda in speeches, briefings, and interviews in the run-up to the invasion of Iraq. Charles Lewis, founder of the Center for Public Integrity, who authored the study, says these top White House officials were not working alone.
Other administration higher-ups, joined by Pentagon officials and Republican leaders in Congress, also routinely sounded false war alarms in the Washington echo chamber. The cumulative effect of these false statements, amplified by thousands of news stories and broadcasts, was massive, with the media coverage creating an almost impenetrable din for several critical months in the run-up to war.
But critics say the same message continues to come from the Bush administration. Today, Vice President Dick Cheney spoke about extending the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act and used the same selling points that White House used after 9/11 on why the government should be able to use wireless wiretapping to, quote, spy on terrorists.
They want to arm themselves with chemical, biological, and nuclear weapons, and they would not hesitate to use such weapons.
Along with references to weapons of mass destruction, he also used images of 9/11 and an imminent threat of danger.
Their tactics, of course, are familiar to all the world. Hijackings like those of 9/11, suicide attacks, car bombs, beheadings, messages of violence and hatred on the internet. Their method is plain. It's to plan in secret and to proceed by stealth so that we won't know what they're up to until a moment of sudden catastrophic violence.
Since there were similar messages with the lead-up to the war in Iraq, some question what can be believed and what cannot. Co-chair of the 9/11 Commission and former Representative Lee Hamilton says the past needs to serve as a lesson.
All of us have to be more skeptical of statements made by our public leaders and scrutinize those statements with very great care.
Thus far, Congress has only held hearings on the quality of pre-war intelligence, but there has been no formal investigation on what was exactly happening in the White House during the lead-up to the invasion. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm Karen Miller.
On Wednesday, Zimbabwean police brutally assaulted opposition members of the Movement for Democratic Change, the MDC, as they marched through the streets of the Zimbabwean capital, Harare. The MDC members were defying a police ban on their planned protest. Earlier in the morning, MDC Party President Morgan Tsvangirai was arrested for his role in planning the march. Davison Makanga reports.
Opposition Movement for Democratic Change, MDC lawyer Alec Muchadayama says law enforcement heavy-handed response to an attempted demonstration march was illegal and against court's ruling. The High Court upheld a police ban on the march but gave the PART a green light to hold a rally at a stadium outside the capital Harare. PART spokesperson Nelson Chamisa says more than 20 people were severely beaten and hospitalized. Chamisa, however, says the PART will hold more protest marches next week.
It shows that these people are not yet ready for free and fair elections. They are not ready for a fair political contest. And we have to continue our march to demand freedom, to demand a new constitution, to demand free and fair elections. Those are the things we are demanding.
Meanwhile, international human rights watchdog Amnesty International has taken a swipe at the Zimbabwe police for selective application of the law. Amnesty says the ruling ZANU-PF PART was allowed to hold more than 10 rallies last month. Amnesty says it believes the government of Zimbabwe's conduct will negate political dialogue facilitated by the Southern African Development Community, an intergovernmental board comprised of countries that span from the Democratic Republic of Congo in the north to South Africa in the south. Key to the negotiations is equal access to the media and political gatherings ahead of the March general elections. Simeon Mawanza is a researcher with Amnesty International based in the United Kingdom.
Now, we're deeply concerned about the conduct and behavior of police in Zimbabwe, especially their attitudes towards members of the opposition MDC, as well as human rights defenders and other civil society organizations. They are violating international human rights standards, particularly treaties that Zimbabwe has ratified, like the African Charter on Human and People's Rights, as well as the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, which guarantee the right to peaceful assembly and peaceful association.
Meanwhile, the opposition MDC is threatening an election boycott if the political playfield continues unchanged. Davison Makanga for Free Speech Radio News, Cape Town.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. Our newscast is supported by Pacifica Radio, community radio affiliate stations, and listener supporters. We podcast at www.fsrn.org. That's fsrn.org. You can email us your feedback, questions, and story ideas to comments@fsrn.org. Our newscast is produced by Monica Lopez and Turner Gusse. Washington, D.C. editor is Leanne Caldwell, and our headlines editor is Shannon Young. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley includes Antonio Ortiz and Rose Kitabji. In Beirut, Lebanon, I'm Jackson Aller, sitting in for Aura Bogado.